Welcome, welcome. It's great to be back again, and thanks for joining us. My guest today is Andrew Horner, CMO and Strategic Marketing Leader. Now, Andrew's got boatloads of experience, including Executive VP of Global Marketing at Symphony, which is a fintech unicorn, and a whole list of other companies, which I'm sure he'll touch upon. And Andrew loves, he's a self-professed storyteller, he loves stories that turn into revenue and growth. And he's joined me today so that we can learn more about how to be great storytellers in the B2B world. So without further ado, Andrew, welcome. And if you'd like to just give us a little bit of background on yourself and your company, fire away.
Great. Hey, thanks for the opportunity. I know folks are busy these days. Attention spans are short, so thanks for paying attention for a little bit. Great. So I'm a lifelong B2B marketer. I actually started my career. I thought I wanted to be a journalist coming out of college, and I actually was a journalist for a very short amount of time. And what I realized is I loved the storytelling, but I was not an investigative reporter. I did not like digging into dirt. I was asked to research stories on toxic waste dumping into rivers and things like that. That was not my cup of tea. However, I love the writing and the storytelling. So a friend of mine said, come to Silicon Valley and do PR. And I did. And it was perfect. It was a great fit. So I learned exactly how to tell a story. I also knew what the journalistic side looks like as well, and what editors are looking for in reporters. So that's carried me forward to this day. So lifelong learner, very curious, always up for a good story. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But here I am today. Yeah.
Excellent. Okay. So how does that translate? Or how does great storytelling work into a marketing angle, such that what is known as fairly B2B, boring to boring, actually starts to maybe even emulate what we see in the B2C world?
Yeah, so great question. I am a student of marketing today, even though I've done a lot of it, and I'm proud of a lot of the work that I've done with my teams. But wow, just there's always room for inspiration, right? And so I pretty actively scroll through places like Instagram and others, and I try and capture, you know, great examples of what I think storytelling is. And some of it is mm-hmm. B2B, and a lot of it, to your point, is B2C. Some of the lessons to learn are the following. You know, it's the classic story structure. It's all around the human. It's all around, you know, drama, tension, or the hero's journey, or something where there's a journey from A to B. Mm-hmm. It's all about kind of timing as well. You have to time things pretty well. It's about keeping things crisp. And if you want a great example of any storytelling, just pick up any fantastic paper, Wall Street Journal, et cetera, and just look at the first sentence of most of the lead stories, right? They never start with boring to boring. They never start with anything dry. It's like, you know, so-and-so, you know, exited the burning house and got into their Porsche and drove away. It's like there's some interesting thing that they just grab you, they pull you right in, right? And I think of it also kind of like the trailers in movies a little bit, right? Sometimes the trailers are better than the film, sadly, and that's true a lot today. Capture it, right? It's snappy, they capture it, they pull you right in a world where something's happening, so-and-so is going to do something. So how does that translate, right? So a couple of things I think about. We do have to think about the structure. Who's the hero? Who's the hero of the story, right? Mm-hmm. And it's probably not you or your product when you're in B2B. It's probably the customer. It's probably someone with a challenge. Although sometimes it could be an employee. I've done employee marketing, and that's fascinating. There's a great stories that come out of that. I'll talk about that in a minute. But it's about structure. So even though a story should flow and feel natural and organic, you know, there is kind of a structure around it, and you've got to think about that. You got to start with the hook, and then kind of build the tension, and then kind of do the reveal, right? So those are a couple of things that I've learned. We use the word authenticity a lot because we aspire to it. It's a tired word in some ways, although it's still a critical word for us. And things do need to feel authentic. As humans, we are very finely tuned to pattern recognition and even kind of microfacial gestures and those things that we're picking up on. And it's the same thing with words in a story that comes through. So if something is contrived or overproduced, often it doesn't come across as well. And I think, there's a lot of like iPhone videos that are popular in kind of B2C. Well, B2B can reflect that. I feel like sometimes we just like to overproduce things with high production values. And while that's appropriate at times, I think people do want something that's a little more realistic and feels a little more realistic. I mean, the shaky cam syndrome can be used effectively, and that's true for writing, and that's true for stories as well. So, those are just a few examples. If you want me to talk a little bit about my process, especially on the B2B side, I think about great fiction, and I think about great fiction where there's a series of books. I think about great fiction where there's kind of a massive multi-year story arc and kind of set of narrative or set of narratives with nested stories within them and then characters nested within that. And I think about how great authors, I'm not going to mention names at the moment, but great authors actually, a lot of them actually plan out kind of the entire series, even in their mind. They might not write it down, but it's in their mind. They have the whole set of arcs, narratives, stories, all that intertwined, and they plot it out so that you might not understand in book one, chapter three, why so-and-so did what they did. But by book four, chapter eight, wow, that was a critical inflection point, right? It's like the old Chekhov's gun, right? There's a gun hanging over the fireplace or whatever, and you know that's going to get used later in the story. You know it's going to be a critical part of it. So I think that that's true for fiction writers, and it has to be true for B2B storytellers as well. So when I was at Symphony, FinTech Unicorn, for 3 years, very proud of my work there. Worked with some stellar executives, David Gurley, Brad Levy, others who really do understand storytelling very effectively. We put together a multi-year kind of story arc, if you will, or set of nested arcs with the narratives and the stories tucked into that. And what we tried to do is plot our stories and our content along that arc so that you might not understand exactly why the story fits in today, but 6 months from now, it's all going to make sense. And if you look back over it, it's going to read like a really great novel, even though Symphony is not the farthest thing from fiction. It's the real business. We grew to 100 million ARR plus, and it was a pretty spectacular growth. So the point is, it's structured, and you plot points along it that lead into each other. And then the other thing that I did at Symphony is and it wasn't just me, it was my team as well. It was my idea, but others really worked hard at it. We established what I call a Storytellers Guild, where we recruited subject matter experts from across the company, the experts in financial services, deep workflows in financial services and collaboration and cybersecurity. And we asked them to contribute in their own voices. We built kind of sub brands around some of these contributors, but they were tying into the overall set of narratives that we were trying to get across. And again, it was very structured. I don't want it to seem like it was too structured, because a lot of it was organic. And the nice thing about the structure is there's flexibility within the structure, right? I think it was Andy Grove said something about like, let chaos reign and then reign in the chaos, right? That's an Intel quote, Andy Grove. And so that's what we did. And so there were times when someone came to me and they're like, hey, this article just came out. I want to reply to that in my next blog post and I'll have it ready for you tomorrow. I'm like, great, we can take that, because we had the framework, we could be flexible within it, but then also adhere to it. So I don't know if I'm over processing.
No, that's great. Just going back to an earlier point there, Andrew, as to, you know, why is storytelling in marketing so effective? Well, if you get it right, it's all about, as you mentioned, it's about developing that deeper connection with the audience. And it's also a powerful way to educate and help people learn. So it's both sort of strategic, I suppose, and there's a tactical element to it as well, because you're getting people to engage. So love that, understand that, really like the way that you've described and set out your process for it, and indeed the structure from the hero through to the hero, whether that's the, and it's obviously not the product, it's the in I think the example you mentioned was an employee. So you're taking real stories, real people, authentic, and as you've just mentioned at Symphony, allowing actually some of the employees to contribute that and create the narrative. I suppose my question would be, Symphony's a really interesting, example here, because you were there, you're very instrumental in building revenue from, I think you mentioned about 30 million ARR up to about 100. So it was a big phase of sort of meteoric growth there. What sort of year was that, Andrew? Well, just give me an idea, because you obviously on the background there, you had a new entrant to that market, Slack, who were, I suppose, to a certain degree, competing with Symfony. Symfony, for listeners, is a collaboration tool used in by banks and financial institutions, so very specialist, but huge market, very successful. And then Slack came onto the space. And in a discussion a couple of days ago we had, is that you mentioned, when we talked about, you know, standout B2B companies, Slack, you mentioned Slack. And just, you know, how good they were. So how was that within the sort of the trenches at Symfony when you saw this new player on the block and their propensity to actually tell good stories as well?
Yeah. Well, yeah. So to be clear on the timing, I'd have to go back and my brain is not giving the exact dates, but both companies were established and growing. So, okay. So it wasn't like there was just a new entrant necessarily, but that said, I think Slack, before I even came into Symfony, when people asked me for examples of great storytelling and great community building, I always brought up Slack, because very early in the day, Slack did a couple clever things. And one of them, first of all, they established a sense of community and they connected humans so that the humans could tell the stories. But then they actually told great stories, and they told founder stories, and they told about how they were different. I think they were a gaming platform at one point that then pivoted and shifted over, if I'm remembering correctly.
So that's right.
They told these stories, and then they told them on social media, and then they amplified them via traditional PR and just blasted this stuff out. And it was intriguing. It was interesting. It was human drama and founders drama. And so it really ignited a lot of interest in the company and helped them grow. So I, even before joining Symfony, I always held them in high regard from a storytelling and marketing standpoint. And then there are other entrants in the space that did come in partway through. And one of them was Microsoft Teams. Microsoft mm-hmm. Teams was kind of stitched together from several different solutions, but they came out of the market very strongly. And of course, COVID accelerated their growth. They did come in partway through my journey at Symfony. And Microsoft, rightly or wrongly, they are good storytellers as well. They've done many campaigns around storytelling. They actually have something called Story Labs, I believe. I don't know if it's still there, but they did have Story Labs at one point where they were gathering and projecting out stories. So even big Microsoft that we all have a love-hate relationship, I respect greatly. Got to meet Bill Gates one time in person, face-to-face. That was fun. But anyway, no one can argue with their tremendous success and their marketing machine. And so their storytelling is part of that too. So long story short is, then what at Symfony, to your point, then what do you do? So do you get defensive? Do you get aggressive competitively? Like, what do you do? And so one of the lessons that I learned at Symfony, again, I worked for two very talented CEOs there. David Gurley was the founder. I worked with him for several years there. And he said, you know, he told me, he said, Andrew, don't go get into the ring and don't go play a chess game, you know, against your competitor. You know, basically create a new game and bring your customers into that game. And so that was very interesting for me, right? That alone is a very intriguing little snippet, right, from a very successful CEO. And so I thought about that also from a storytelling standpoint. So we tried to do that quite a bit at Symfony, where we would not go attack our competitors, our perceived competitors directly. But what we would do is we take elements of what they were doing. And then we'd say, well, why don't we think about this a different way, right? And we'd shift the story, we'd shift the conversation, we'd back it up with the facts and the proof points. And we did that with both Microsoft and Slack. Now, they're both fierce competitors. They took massive market share. They grew very fast. I'm proud of the growth at Symfony. We were in a slightly smaller part of the market, mostly focused on financial services. We had tremendous success, you know, hundreds of thousands of users actively using us for critical collaboration and chat. So we captured that, and we appealed to that, and we put on several conferences, both virtual during COVID and live, where we actually did not get up on stage and pitch at all. In fact, for most of our conference, which is a full day conference, last live one we had was in New York City, and we basically asked our customers to come up on stage and show a live demo, not pre-recorded, not canned, not faked, a live demo.
Nice.
How they were actually using the product, but not just using the product, what their workflow was, what their context was, how it plugged into their, their workflows. And so that was not even us saying it. That was someone else saying it in a very intriguing way, where you had audience members leaning forward. And at one point, at one of the events, our sales folks there had their phones lighting up with messages from other customers saying, I want to buy what I just saw on stage.
Wow.
So, okay, when I talk about connecting stories to revenue, you don't get much better than that, where you have your customers telling a phenomenal story up on stage in front of all your other prospects and customers, and you literally have pipeline filling that moment when that's happening. Now, does that happen every day? No. Can you scale that? Maybe. Is that marketing success? You better believe it.
That's really impressive. Wow. I suppose also fairly ballsy, right? Because, you know, it's live. Things go wrong. So you've got to be prepared to go out on a limb a little bit and just be prepared.
Life is live.
Absolutely.
It's a high wire act with no net. It's a high wire. So why not? That's part of the tension, right? It works.
No. Absolutely. And of course, if the spanner hits the works, then again, it's about how you deal with that at that time. And people understand things happen. But no, really like that story, Andrew. Oh, excellent.
If I can give a shout out to my colleague, Catherine, who ran that whole operation seamlessly, I will. Hi, Catherine. How are you doing?
Well done, Catherine. I'm sure she's going to be in high demand now. you are a proponent of building teams, even if they're the other side of the world, Andrew, in terms of building out marketing teams and talent. And I think your expression is talent first, i.e., just because they're not within a bus ride or a tube ride of the HQ office doesn't mean they can't be in your team. And in fact, well, credit to you. You've built teams that with very highly talented individuals that you've never met, and that hasn't held you back, or indeed the companies that you've worked with. So my question to you would be: what do you look for when you're hiring a marketer and you want them to step into the role of, hey, we really need you to understand this storytelling business? What do you look for? What skill set?
Yep. That's a great question. So even as a data-driven marketer, we're always dealing with human beings, and we have to go to some of the softer factors. So I'm going to mention that in a minute. But first of all, yes, even before COVID, I've managed and hired and high-performing distributed teams all over. At Symphony, the team was everywhere from Hong Kong to London to New York to Silicon Valley and beyond. And then prior to that, even when I was back at McAfee, as it was acquired by Intel during that time, in the Dave DeWalt days, again, great set of stories. We could have a whole separate session on that time. But I had folks in India and the Nordics and Massachusetts and California, and we never even met. So some of the teams never even met physically. This is well before COVID, just because we didn't. But we worked together seamlessly, and we time shifted, and we like followed the sun. And if one team member didn't get something done, they'd pass it and it'd be done by the next morning when you woke up. And you do leverage the time zones as best you can. And I think it's very important to think about that. Mm-hmm. And then there's a couple other things. Let's talk about them that are a little bit softer, but I'll talk about it. So first, one of the lessons I learned, FSISAC was a company I spent some time at, and they were an information sharing group. We grew from about 2,000 logos to about 7,000 all over the world. They do cyber threat intelligence sharing. And Bill Nelson, who had been the CEO at the time, and I got along famously. Great respect for Bill Nelson there. But what he taught me is a sense of mission and purpose. And we talk about those things more today, but back then we didn't in B2B talk about those things quite as much. And so that sense of mission and purpose is critical. So if your team shares a sense of mission, if they share a sense of purpose, that alone goes most of the way, even when you're distributed. And then within the mission, I learned from my friends in military and law enforcement. I did not serve, but I have great respect. I have many friends that did. There's something called commander's intent, the commander's intent. So the commander's intent is how within a specified time period you're going to deliver on the mission. Okay. And sadly, within our world today, which is kind of feels like it's always on the precipice of war, maybe the military analogies aren't the best. So I'm sorry about that. But it's just something I've used because I think mission goes beyond just military. But the commander's intent is like within 12 months, how will my team actually deliver the mission that we've set up for? When you put these structures in place, then the next things I think about is when I'm going to hire is I think, is this person curious? Are they passionate? Are they collaborative? And can we have cohesion within the team? Now, I know executives that purposefully hire teams that have dissonance so that they feel like that will churn things up and be creative. I haven't found that to be, it can work. I haven't found it to be super effective. And I think it's mentally exhausting, frankly. So what I like to, I'm not saying you shouldn't have opinions that are different. That's very healthy. And my team often has, my teams often do that. They debate, but you have to be cohesive. You have to come together. And at the end of the day, you know, there's the old Amazon, you know, disagree, but commit, right? And that's used in Amazon. It's used in Intel and other places. You have to have that mentality where we're going to have a healthy debate. We're going to make a decision and we're going to move forward as a team. So those, I'm just giving you a flavor of it. We could talk for days on this, but I'm just trying to give you a flavor of how.
No, that helps. That helps. So let me just replay my understanding of that is that what you effectively said is, look, just because they're not sitting next to you, it doesn't mean that you cannot hire and manage and build a very successful team, as long as the structure on which they join into the organization, there is a sense of mission and purpose, which is articulated, everybody's singing off the same hymn sheet, and they buy into that. And once they buy into that and they understand the commander's intent, i.e. where are they going and what's the time scale, and they have those personal qualities of passionate and they're able to collaborate. If you bring all that together, it doesn't matter. You can actually, it doesn't matter about whether they're in the room or not. You can build a really strong collaborative team. And you've done it in marketing with some great logos and some really talented executives, but also some very talented people that you brought to the table to deliver. So I think that's my takeaway, Andrew, right? And whether they're storytellers or whether they're demand gen or whatever, that same applies. But the takeaway there for me is the sense of mission and purpose and the leadership and the intent. And I think there's a lot in that.
If I can just add to that, I'm sorry, there's a little lag. I don't mean to be talking over you. If I can just add for a moment, there's a lot of conversation, I think, over the past few years around diversity and inclusion. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because I guess I've always felt that that is important and I naturally put that in. So when there's a distinct focus on it, it almost feels unnatural because it should already feel natural. But we should always be diverse and inclusive in what we're doing as we're recruiting. And in addition to all the other kind of factors of that, which are really important, I also think intellectual diversity is an interesting concept too. And you also have to have the intellectual diversity on the teams too. So you just spurred that thought. I feel like I do need to comment on it. It just should be a no-brainer to have a diverse, inclusive team with intellectual diversity. I just want to mention that.
Yeah, no, thanks for that. It's almost like what you're saying. It's a given that you're gonna hire from a diverse pool, and you're going to be inclusive, and you're not just going to hire everybody who's come out of Harvard or Cambridge. You want a cross mix of people who can bring different opinions to the table, because guess what? The audience that you're selling to are not in one shape or mold. So you need to have that. You need to have that. I suppose the depth of experience and opinions. Yeah, got that. Like that. Really good. Okay, so that's, Andrew, I'm going to just pivot slightly now into your career path. You're now the CMO of a fast-growing company, which we're going to learn a little bit about because I find it fascinating. It's highly relevant in the cybersecurity space, particularly since COVID, when even more people are accessing company and corporate apps remotely. So we're going to learn a little bit about ValidSoft. But as a CMO there, and looking at your career path, including Symfony and McAfee, et cetera, I'd say that, and it's a conversation we did have a couple of days ago, it's really about most marketeers will sort of scale up. They'll go from small company and they get to the biggest company. And that's sort of the path. They've climbed Everest, okay? But for a marketeer then to scale down, having been at a big enterprise and come down the food, where actually they've got to roll their sleeves up again, get their hands dirty, and they're not just shouting from the pulpits, they're actually doing the stuff. I'd say that sort of categorizes or characterizes your journey. Right. Would you agree with that? Is that you've done both, right? Tell us a little bit about that.
I've done both. And it's a conversation I actually had with a couple of very talented entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley years ago, where we had this discussion because we were talking about hiring. We were trying to hire, I think, a VP of sales at the time. And we interviewed all these candidates that bragged about how they could scale up. And then what we realized is we were at an A going into B series startup, funded startup. Mm-hmm. And we were like, no, we actually need people that can scale down, then back up. So absolutely to your point. But it's also like you have the muscle memory, but you might not have used those muscles in a while. So it's like going to the gym after being an aggressive, gym workout person. And again, COVID has disrupted all that for all of us. But and then going back to the gym and saying it's going to be, leg day. I'm like Dwayne The Rock Johnson, I'm going to do leg day today. And you haven't done it in 2 months. And so you got to do it. So yeah, 100%. I do believe that great marketing leaders are player coaches. They are kind of servant leaders, to use the term. I don't know if that's a great term or not, but we are in service of our team and the organization. But that said, 100%. So one of the things, just to put a fine point on it, is let me give you an example. When you scale down, okay, when you scale up, you take and turn like sprints and bursts of activity, and you systematize those, and maybe you do 2 week sprints, and you really are accountable monthly to the board, and then at quarterly results matter, right? That's the kind of the mm-hmm. thinking and mm-hmm. cadence. When you scale back down, every hour matters, every day matters, every day it's a door to door battle to go take and win momentum and keep going. It's like, and every call matters, and every bit of content you write matters. I'm not saying it doesn't when you scale up, but when you scale up, there's more around you to buffer, right? You can kind of focus on one thing to build it while something else is already spun up. But when you're scaling down, like, the bright light's on you every hour, every day, and you've got to make it count. And so that's something that I knew, and I've done it many times, but I kind of forgot. And so I had to get back into that mode and mentality. I'm like, oh, I can't take my foot off the gas even for a day, even for an hour. Is this call productive? Is this call moving the needle? Should I be in that meeting? Like, you have to make those kinds of decisions. And it is a mental, not a burden, but it takes mental effort to get in that mm-hmm. mode and that rhythm. So what I think is interesting is it also triggered something that I've used several times over, which is what I call a flow state, where you try and get deep into something and you just focus so tightly on that you accomplish a lot more in a specified period of time than if you took a normal time to do it. So for example, my old rule was, it takes me 4 hours roughly to write a great piece of short form content, because you write it, you edit it, when all is said and done, about 4 hours, give or take, right? Well, I'm realizing I can do that in 30 or 45 minutes if I get into the flow state. And again, writing is all about editing. You have to come back and edit it. I'm not saying don't do that, but I'm saying, why should something take 4 hours? Maybe you can compress it. Maybe you can collapse it. And so, at this organization and others that I advise, I'm saying, look, you've got to compress months into weeks, weeks into days, and days into hours. And you got to figure out how to do that. And you cut out all the other fluff, and you just focus on that stuff. And you try and get at least once every day or two, you try and get into a flow state where you can do the deep work faster, effectively. And you're just in that zone. The athletes call it in the zone. And so that's a really important characteristic of it.
Yeah, interesting. I sort of understand why some people might not want to go back and scale down when they're in an organization where there's so much buffer they can effectively hide. I can understand why people might opt for that, because the route of scaling down, rolling your sleeves up, having to compress everything as you've just described, is not the easy route, right? I wouldn't imagine. Yeah. It's going to take more energy. What about burnout? I mean, how many people have you come across where actually they just weren't up to it? They just burnt out. They weren't able to get into the flow state. They're multitasking all over the place, and it just doesn't work. Do you see that?
I do. I also see people that get kind of too comfortable, but it takes a different toll as well. So in my career, the times where I felt the best about things are when I am in not just my flow state, but there are other flows happening and I'm in those flows and I'm connected and I'm listening to what I'm having one-to-one conversations with customers and partners and influencers and analysts, and that data is flowing. And then I'm sharing back, I'm taking in, I'm giving back out. I'm kind of a conduit of flow, whether that's information or work, and things move very fast. But things also move in a way where you know you're moving things forward. You are moving that needle. Those environments to me are the most stimulating. And yes, multitasking and burnout and grinding employees is not the right thing either. And we all have our moments. I had to pull an all-nighter the other night to get some things done. I don't want to do that, but I do it. Mm-hmm. But that said, it's not that. There's a sense of fulfillment. There's a sense of contribution. There's a sense of purpose. And there's a sense of achievement when you are cycling and flowing and shipping stuff. And it's not stuck somewhere in a corporate review at the lawyer's office. You know, like, that sense of closure on things and getting them done and shipped, even if they're imperfect and you can go back and fix them later, that to me is that's better, right, than trying to hide behind something or seeing what I can get away with. That's never been my mentality. And I think great marketers love that sense of accomplishment. That's, it's almost like publishing, right? It's like, you know, they say in university, publish or perish, right? And for marketers, it's true too. We have to publish or we perish. And again, yes, there's burnout, but on the other side of it, there's ennui. And you can't have that either. I've seen that as well. You don't want that. Those are both enemies, right? You got to be in the zone, in the middle, in the flow, being creative, leveraging data, taking in, giving out. And that's true for life as well. That's not just business, right?
No, absolutely. And when it all comes together like that, as you said, that is a wonderful feeling, whether you're in business or whether you're doing your best sport that you like, and it all just comes together. Okay, thank you for that. Excellent.
And there are moments for rest too, though, right? If you think about the day after the Super Bowl in the US, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the teams work incredibly hard, they're exhausted, they gave it their all, they put on a good show, but then you take the downtime too. So I don't want to ever say you don't. And I believe in mental health and protecting that. I believe in having quiet moments and just moments of nothingness, because sometimes the best ideas come during those moments. Go for a hike, go for a walk, whatever you meditate, whatever you need to do. That's the soft stuff. And you have to do that as well and protect that time. But when you're working hard and you've accomplished something, that relaxation is so much sweeter because you've achieved, right? And then you get to relax a little bit and then you dive back in and go at it again.
Yeah, I definitely reiterate that. Celebrate the wins, even the small ones, because they are they're the fuel that keeps you going. Excellent. Yep. Now, when we spoke a couple of days back, Andrew, you shared a really great story about when you were interviewing with ValidSoft. Because I asked you, I said, look, how did you decide to go from Symphony to ValidSoft? And although I find that whole market in terms of identity management, identity security, really interesting, I was curious as to why you decided to choose ValidSoft. And you told me a story, which to me is the classic storytelling, which was about the presentation that they gave to you. And I think there was a sort of penny dropped at that point, and you said, wow, this is fascinating. Can you share that with our listeners, please?
So it's one example. So basically, just to summarize, what ValidSoft does is voice biometrics for authentication. So when you dial into your bank and they say, we want to authenticate you using your voice instead of knowledge-based factors like asking 8 questions or whatever, you know, that's the type of technology that this company offers. And so the CEO has identical twin daughters. And the demo that I saw, the video that I saw was each of the daughters had an iPhone and it was protected by Face ID for authentication. And each of the daughters handed each other their iPhones, and they were able to break the Face ID. So the Face ID confused the identical twins and allowed each other to access each other's phones. But then when voice biometrics was applied, it failed. The test fails. And so the twins cannot access each other's phone, because even with identical twins, the voice kind of cavity and chamber and tones and all that are different, slightly different, maybe even not to the human ear, but actually you can take a voice print and break it into about 150 components in real time, analyze it, compare it, and see if that's that human. And it proves that it's the human or not. So,
yeah. And it was that that made you think, wow, this is an exciting era. We've got to be able to tell that story. We've got to educate. Because I think, you know, voice biometrics and the voice print is still a little bit behind in terms of the educating the market. So I think that there's a great job to be done there. And I love the expression that you use, that puff of air from your lungs is really your unique identity. And also to say how you also described to me how that you can separate out the personal information from that voice. So for example, you can't just copy someone's audio and use that to access it. So I think that's what you mentioned about ValidSoft having some unique characteristics there.
Yeah, there's a lot of focus on deep fakes and replay attacks. And especially as we've gone to a distributed world where even contact center agents that used to sit in a corporate campus are now working from home, you need to make sure the human being is who they say they are. And voice is one of the only ways to really do that in a disconnected world. You can't have fingerprint scanners everywhere, retinal scanners or DNA mm-hmm. swabs everywhere. Those are other biometric factors, right? But voice is very mobile and flexible and fluid and extensible. And you can do it on the phone or the computer or other places like that too. So I think we're going to see a lot more uptake in it. Yep.
Yeah, fascinating. Look forward to learning more about that. Okay, so we're going to move into quick fire section of the of our show here. And, you know, B2B Uncovered is all about learning from experienced marketeers, sales and growth people who've been there. They've been at the coalface. Do you understand? Do you have that expression, by the way, Andrew, at the coalface? Do you know what I mean by that?
I do know what you mean. And that's a story for a separate time, but go ahead.
Okay, good. Okay. So yeah, you've been there. You've got the war wounds. You've got the scars. Question to you would be, what's your biggest failure and what did you learn from it?
All right. I love the question and happy to answer in a couple different ways. First of all, years ago, I came up with this expression that I didn't coin it, but other people took it and ran with it. And it was called fast fail. And so, yes, we all experience failure, but failure is actually a part of it. And you got to have that. And so then again, one of the CEOs I respect a lot told me, you know, Andrew, turn that into a positive. So I did. So I now have a concept I call fast fail, fast fix. And sometimes I even take the word fail out because no one really wants to fail. And I talk about fast fix. So I'll answer your question in a moment. What I'm saying is I've actually incorporated the concept of failing fast into marketing, because as marketers, we have to test, we have to iterate, we have to do multivariate testing, A/B testing, because the data speaks. And even with our best hypothesis, we don't always know. We don't always know the answer. But when you build that ability to fail and take a little bit of risk into it, you can test your hypotheses, get the data, get the feedback, iterate and improve. So I just want to mention that as a process point. Mm-hmm. But in terms of failure, I will tell you, and it's not a marketing failure, it's a career failure. I was at a company many years ago, very early in my career, called Blue Martini. It was an IPO that I went with the company through IPO. It was a tremendous time. And we had just gone IPO and we were the kind of a darling company and the stock price was high and everyone was thinking, picking out their Aston Martins and the catalogs and things like that. And a little company in Silicon Valley called me up out of the blue, the recruiter did, while I was at Blue Martini. And they said, you know, we've seen all the stuff you're doing over the press, you're doing the investor relations, that we love what we see and we'd like you to come talk to our team about building our PR and communications practice at this company. And I just immediately said, no, I'm at a company that just went IPO. And, you know, I wasn't humble at that time, right? I hadn't learned humility. And so, and then they called me again a month later and they said, you know, please, can you just come have lunch with us? In fact, even if we don't recruit you, we just want to talk to you about what you are doing over there. We'd love to just listen and hear what you're doing because we like what we see from a communication standpoint externally. And I again said no. And I went and I told my wife who the company was, and she said, "You're an idiot. You should have talked to him." Well, that little company was Google. So Blue Martini was a spectacular success, and I'm proud of the work there, but then it wasn't. And it faded into the history books. And Google, of course, has not faded in the history books. And so that was my mistake. So the lessons I learned there, that was a career mistake. The lessons I learned there were be more humble, be willing to have a conversation, open yourself up a bit, and listen, and especially listen to your spouse. I think that's a big lesson. That was the clear one. And I've had other things that would have failed. I have run huge branding initiatives with agencies that are very expensive, and sometimes they turn out phenomenally well and change the course of the company, and sometimes they just don't work out quite as well. And you have to actually take and discard it, even though you've spent the money. You don't throw good money after bad money. I've had my sense of failures too. But that's okay. As long as you learn from them. I think Esther Dyson says, famous technologist, said, never make the same mistake twice. So it's okay to make new mistakes. Mm-hmm. Actually, the phrase is always make new mistakes is the way that was phrased. So if you always make a new mistake, it means you're learning, you're iterating, you're improving, but it's also you give yourself the safety to be able to make a mistake.
Yeah, great advice. And I think to work in a team where you have the capacity and it's accepted to be able to take those decisions and make those mistakes is crucial, as opposed to overtly sort of micromanaging everything so that, people feel scared and frightened to take those risks. That's good advice. Okay. Next question. What have you read or listened to recently that's inspired you?
Great point. So a couple things. I can look back behind me on the bookshelf here. I have my books separated into kind of B2B and marketing type books and business books, and then fiction as well. But there's a couple things I'm kind of rereading. So Principles, Ray Dalio, is behind me, and I'm kind of scanning back through that. I've got Mark Benioff, Trailblazers, which I'm kind of slowly making my way through. I scanned it before, but I'm doing that. And then the other thing is I do have this book called Living in the Flow, and that also is it ties into the flow concept. And again, none of these are kind of canon, none of these are all encompassing, but I think taking bits and pieces of the best of it and being inspired by those things, just little snippets of things. And then the other thing that basically is kind of creating inspiration in me is I am actually watching my wife ramp up her own entrepreneurial journey in business right now. And so that is very inspiring. And my daughter is actually working with her and getting a real life MBA. I mean, honestly, they are living and breathing every bit of work and how you scale a company and bootstrap it. And that's inspiring because I get to watch that. I get to advise, but I also get to watch that and the success there too. So.
Oh, that's fantastic. And how old is your daughter, if you don't mind me asking?
She is just heading up on 18, coming up on 18.
Wow. What a great opportunity. Congratulations to both of them. Excellent. Okay. So let me have a look here. Thank you for that. Now, you also state you love building things, right? What's the best thing you've ever built?
Yep. Okay. Well, one of the things I'm proud about is when I was at FSISAC, one of the reasons I was brought in is it wasn't just a consortium of information sharing. It actually, they spun out several initiatives, including SaaS technology and software. And so in some ways they were like an incubator, and I was part of that. So my night job was being kind of the acting CMO for these incubated ideas. And one of them was Soltra. And Soltra is interesting. Soltra basically automated the concept of threat intelligence sharing. So all the big banks, actually, you'd think they would kind of hold tight to their cyber threat intelligence, but they don't. It's a community defense model. And so all the big banks in real time share threats when the threat actors come in and try and attack their websites, their servers, et cetera. So the banks share this information so they can protect themselves. And so Soltra was a spinoff that basically was funded by the big banks. We had a separate team running it, a very talented team that has gone on to do some great things. And we spun it up from scratch. It was nothing. It was a zero.
Wow.
There was a little bit of software code. We commercialized that code. We took it to market. We built, I think it was a $25 million pipeline within about 9 or 10 months with very little. We were bootstrapped. We didn't even have much marketing budget at all. And so let me, the thing I'm proud about though is the brand. So when I talk about marketing, I often say it's, if you really distill it down using Occam's razor, it's brand and demand. Brand and demand. And most CEOs, that's what they care about. There's many other pieces to it, but if you care about brand and demand. So we had the demand side set on Soldier. We needed the brand. And so I did a lot of research into historical models of information sharing. And one of the things I came across was when Viking invaders came across the ocean to attack Europe, the European castles had an information sharing system, but guess what it was? It was lighting bonfires on top of turrets on castles to warn when the Vikings were coming. So one castle that was miles away would light the bonfire at the very topmost part of the castle. And then it would, and in daytime, they'd see the smoke. At nighttime, they'd see the fire. The other castle knew that the Vikings had just landed on shore and were coming to attack. They'd get ready. It gave them time to prepare, right? How could you find a better analogy to information sharing and cyber threat intelligence? I don't know about that. That's a pretty darn good one. And so one of the most famous castles that did this was called Soltra Edge. Well, that's a nice phrase. I like that one. So I grabbed that one and we ran with it. And we always told the story around the brand. And we had a great logo. And actually the logo won an Addy Award, which I'm very proud of. And it was a team doing it. It wasn't just me. But I'm very proud of it. We won an Addy Award for the logo. It was a great story lead in when we're having sales discussions. And there was a nice kind of integrity to the story, talking about the company was Soltra, the product was Soltra Edge. And basically 1,000 years ago, people shared threat intelligence in real time. And today we're sharing threat intelligence in real time in the bank. So that I would say I have a lot of things I'm proud of. I'm proud of the time at Symphony. I'm proud of the time at McAfee and Intel. But you know what? That was a bright spot for sure. That was a good one.
I love that. And I just love that because I can pick, you know, you've just told me, you just described that. And I've already got the picture in my head. I could see the burning fires on top of the turrets. And it just does exactly what we're talking about here. You've told a story. And you've related it. You've put some context in there in terms of the 1,000-year history to it. So fantastic. Thank you for sharing that. Okay. So last question, Andrew. What should marketeers be doing today to create more trust with buyers?
Yeah, trust is a good word. It's one of my favorite words. And it's something that we actually added to our corporate values at Symphony, that concept of trust. And it's so easy to lose it and it's so hard to gain it. So what I would say is the first thing is, you want to know what the first thing is? The first thing is just listen. And I'll pause for dramatic effect. As marketers, we should listen more. Executives should listen more. We love to talk. We love to pitch our product. We love to say stuff. We love to tell stories. We love to tell what's on our mind. But I think the first part about trust is listening actively and then reflecting that back, not just listening and taking it, but reflecting back that we've heard someone, right? And so I think that's the first thing in building trust. And then the second thing is the old adage of say what you're going to do and do what you say. And it's so easy to just let one little thing go. You can't do that. So deliver on your promises. I lived in a Midwestern state in the US called Missouri. It's right next to Illinois, St. Louis, Missouri. And Missouri has on their license plate, it's the show me state. It's the show me state. And I always took that as a teenager. And I thought, yeah, that's true. So trust is about listening. It's about making promises, but then you got to show it. You got to live in the show me state. And I think those are a few ways. I mean, those are a few ways to build trust. There's many other ways to do it. And a lot of it's one-to-one. A lot of things, it's not B2B. It's H-to-H. It's human to human. It's person to person. And I think sometimes when we're trying to scale, we forget about that. We want to blast out an email to hundreds or thousands of people. And guess what? These are human beings. So figure that out.
Perfect. What a great way to end this episode. I'd like to thank you. It's been a real pleasure, Andrew. Thank you for sharing your insights, your thoughts, and being very transparent with us today. as my guest. I've really enjoyed the conversation. But before we wrap up, why don't you tell listeners where they could find out a little bit more about you and how to get in touch if they so desire?
I am a big, I'm actually an early user of LinkedIn, and I'm a big fan of that. So you can find me on LinkedIn. I'm there. I am on Twitter, although I'm not as active as I was prior, but LinkedIn's probably the best way to do that. So happy to connect, and I'm happy to network. I do believe in community and the sense of network, and happy to help anyone or connect or make connections. So.
That's great. Talking about early user of LinkedIn, I remember, I don't know if you had it, I remember them awarding a badge for being in the first 1 million users, which we had on the profile page at one point. And now what is it? Is it 500 million plus? Yeah, pretty good. It was Microsoft that bought it, haven't they? Microsoft bought it. Yeah, pretty good buy, I would have thought, at 25 billion. Excellent. Thanks again, Andrew. And thank you to all our listeners. Have a fabulous day. And as we stay here on B2B Uncovered, never stop learning. See you on the next episode. Thanks again for joining me on B2B Uncovered. If you liked this episode, then please hit the subscribe button. Want to go the full hog? Hey, yeah, I'd love a rating from you. Just tap the number of stars that you'd like to give us. As we're just getting going, that's going to help tremendously. Thank you.